Sin in Space, Chapter 8. Inside, the baby was wailing lustily again. From her position on the couch, Polly raised a commanding arm. "Turn him over, Jim. He'll probably stop crying if you put him on his tummy." Tony watched while the new father slid his hand under his son's back with an exquisite caution that belied his proud air of assurance. Turning to hide his smile, the doctor began piling hospital equipment on the hand truck to take back with him when he went.
"Look! Tony, look! Look at Sonny!"
"Sonny, is it?" The doctor turned around slowly. "So he's lost all his dignity already. I was wondering how you were going to get around that tongue twister of a name. Well, what do you know?" He watched the baby struggle briefly, then rear back and lift his head upright. He had to admit there was cause for pride in Polly's voice when a baby not yet 2 days old could do that. "Well," the doctor teased, "he's Sun Lake City Colony Candro, after all. You ask anybody in town if that doesn't make a difference. I won't be surprised if he walks next week and starts doing long division in the first month. Who knows? He might learn how to eat pretty soon." He realized abruptly he'd made a mistake. Neither parent was ready to joke about that.
"Doc," Jim said hesitantly, "you're pretty sure there's nothing wrong?"
"I told you before," Tony said shortly, "I'm not sure of a blessed thing. If you can see a single reason to believe there's anything wrong with that baby, I wish you'd tell me, because I can't, but this is Mars. I can't make promises, and I'll make damn few flat statements. You can go along with me and trust me, or..." There was no alternative, and his brief irritation was already worn out. "You cannot trust me and go along with me. We have to feel our way, that's all. Now," he said briskly, "you're all checked out on the mask? No trouble with it?"
"No, it's all right. I'm sorry, Doc."
"Got enough tanks?" Tony interrupted. "You gave us enough to go from here to Jupiter," Polly put in.
"Listen, Tony, please don't think we..."
"What I think," Tony told her, "is that you're good parents, naturally concerned about your child, and that I had no business blowing off. Now let's forget it."
"No," Jim said firmly. "I think you ought to know how we... I mean, there's no question in anyone's mind about trusting you. Hell, how do I go about saying this? What I want to tell you is..."
"He wants to say," said Polly from the bed, "that we're both very grateful for what you've done. It's a happiness we thought we'd never know."
"That's it," said Jim.
"He's your baby," said Dr. Tony. "Do a good job with him." He pushed the hand truck to the door and waited for Jim to come and help him ease it through. "Oh, by the way," he added, smiling, "I'll fill out the birth certificate tonight, now that I know the name, if you'll come over and..."
"Doc!"
It was Hank Radcliffe running down the street, breathless and distraught.
"Doc, come quick! Joan's dying!"
Tony grabbed his black bag and raced down the street with Hank plowing along beside him.
"What happened?"
"When I took her out in the tote truck," Hank panted, "before she could walk to the street, she toppled right over and..."
"Walk? You let her walk?"
"But she told me you said it was all right." The youngster seemed close to tears.
"Joan told you that?"
They slowed in front of the Radcliffe hut. Tony wiped the anger off his face and went in. Joan was on the bunk in a parka. The doctor stripped it off and applied his stethoscope. He had adrenaline into her heart in 30 seconds and then sat grim-faced at the edge of the bunk, not taking the black disc from her chest.
"Get that coffee," he snapped at Hank without turning. "The stuff they found in the shakedown."
Hank raced out. After long minutes, Tony exhaled heavily and put away the stethoscope. She'd pulled through once more. The girl lifted her parchment-like eyelids and looked at him dully.
"I feel better now," she whispered. "I guess I fainted."
"You don't have to talk." Tony sat again on the edge of the bed. She was silent for a minute, laying back with her eyes closed. He picked up her bird's claw of a hand. The pulse was racing now.
"Dr. Tony?" she asked.
"I'm right here. Don't try to talk. Go to sleep."
"Is Hank here?"
"He'll be back in a minute."
"I want to tell you something, Dr. Tony. It wasn't his fault. I didn't tell him the truth. I told him you said it was all right for me to walk."
"You knew better than that."
"Yes. Yes, I did. I know you'll have to send me back to Earth."
"Never mind about that, Joan."
"I do, Dr. Tony. Not for me, for Hank. That's why I did it. I'd go back for the colony because it isn't fair of me to take up all your time, but what about Hank? If I went back, he'd have to go back too. He couldn't stay here in the colony if I were on Earth, alive." "What are you talking about?" demanded the doctor, though he knew with terrible certainty what she meant, what she had tried to do. "Of course he's going back with you. He loves you. Don't you love him?" She smiled a little and said softly, without urgency, "Yes, I love him." And then, again, hysterically, "But this is what he's wanted all his life. He doesn't feel the way I do about the colony, the wonderful way we're all working together for everybody. With him, it's Mars, ever since he was a little boy. He's in the colony, and he works hard, and everybody likes him, but it would be enough for him to be a prospector like old Leroy. Ever since he was a little boy, he used to dream about it. You know how he's always going out into the desert." "Tell him he doesn't have to go back with me. Tell him I'll be all right. Talk to the shareholders. Make them let him stay. It would break his heart to send him back." Tony didn't dare excite her by telling her that they might all be sent back, that the colony was a failure. Even if they pulled through by a miracle, Hank couldn't stay. They called it the M-or-M rule, married or marriageable. Far from the lunacies of the jam-packed Earth, they had meant to build with children and allowed no place for new immigrant women past childbearing, or for Hank in love with a woman returned to Earth. It didn't matter now, he thought. Joan Radcliffe had wanted death and been cheated of it by adrenaline. Sonny Candro wanted life, which meant his mother's breast, but some savage irony was cheating him, too. Newly born, 5 pounds of reflexes depending on the key suckling reflex that somehow was scrambled. Sonny lay awake without crying, didn't seem to need sleep, could lift his head. All right, put that down to lighter gravity, even though the Bergen's little Loretta hadn't done it. Sonny had a wonderful color, a powerful nursing instinct, but he choked and gagged at the breast. Without fuel, the machine of reflexes would run down and stop. It didn't make sense to Tony. He had guiltily half-lied to the Candros when he told them many babies didn't know how to nurse at first. That was the truth. The lie was that this baby knew how, but choked all the same. A feeding problem, they would have blandly called it on Earth, where there were still millions of cows, sterile hospitals, relays of trained nurses for intravenous nourishment regimes. Here, a feeding problem was a feeding problem. Any one of the wealthier industrial colonies would automatically have taken Earth import powdered milk from its stores, but Sun Lake couldn't afford it, didn't have any. And what was more, Sun Lake wouldn't get powdered milk if Commissioner Bell made good on his threat. If Sonny died, it would be worse than the unnamed little boy the Connollys had lost, and he had left a scar on the doctor's mind that time would never heal. Tony could still see the agonized blue face and the butterfly grasping for air, a preemie, but he never should have cleared Mrs. Connolly. 7 months gone until they'd had oxygen cylinders and masks and a tent for emergencies. The Connollys had shipped back to Earth on the next rocket after the tragedy. The father had cursed him insanely, damned him for a killer because he hadn't foreseen the need of oxy gear for their baby 2 months before it was due. Oxen they had, but oxen made no change in the lungs of a baby. He'd given it intravenously, orally, in every solvent he could lay his hands on during the desperate hours before the improvised mask fed the last trickle of oxygen from their single tank into the lungs of the infant. Tony forced his face into a smile as he passed a couple, Flexner and his girl, Virna. Behind the smile, he was thinking that it would be harder to bear a mute reproach from the patient Candros than Connolly's raging curses. Tony dragged the loaded hand truck into the middle of his living room and left it there. He could put the stuff away later. It was getting late now, and he had yet to make his afternoon radiation inspection at the lab. There was a package on the table. He took time to pick it up and read, "For Dr. Tony, from Jim and Polly Candro, with much thanks." For a moment he held it, weighing it in his hand. No, he decided. He'd open it later, when there was time to relax and appreciate the sentiment that lay behind it. The gift itself would have to be, meaningless. There was no way for any colonist to purchase or procure anything at all from the outside, except for the very few personal treasures that were somehow squeezed into the rigid weight limit on baggage when they came out. All plastic chairs and sinks, blankets, and windows were uniformly functional and durable. But they were uniform, and they were also scarce. Each household contained the same irreducible minimum. Lab space and work hours were too precious to be used for the production of local consumption items. Tony closed his door behind him and set out for the lab once more. Dull, monotonous, primitive, uncomfortable, he raged inwardly. Every home, inside and out, just the same. Why had they come to Mars? for a better, saner way of life, to retrieve some of the dignity of men, to escape from the complexities, inequities, and fear pressures of Earth. And what were they doing? Building a new life with hard work and suffering on the precise pattern of the old. There wasn't a person in the colony who wouldn't do better back on Earth. He found the lab in an uproar. All work had stopped, so the grim hunt for the Markane could go on. Nick had already begun an inventory. "Make this an extra good check, Doc," Tony was told in the office before he started out. "We'll be handling a lot of stuff that hasn't been used in a long time, and getting into all the corners, too." "Are the checkout tubes racked yet?" Tony asked. "Right. We issued new ones to the men on the inspection squad." "I'll do them first," the doctor decided, and went into the cleanup room, where the wall racks were already lined with the tubes for that day. Usually they were checked in the following morning's inspection, but today the plant had closed down early for all practical purposes. The tubes checked clean all down the line. Tony selected a fresh tube from the opposite wall and went on out through the shipping room to the workrooms. He didn't need armor for the afternoon inspection. The technicians had been in there this morning, and if their tubes were all clean, there couldn't be any deadly hot stuff. The purpose of the late-day check was to catch reactions that were just starting up, and that might make trouble overnight. In the morning, it was different. Anything that had been chaining for 12 or more hours could be vicious. Back in the office when he was finished, Tony reported a clean check through. "What," he asked, "are you going to do about the shipment crates?" "Leave them till last," Mimi Jonathan told him. "If anything turns up in the workrooms or storage bins, we'll have to open up the shipment crates one at a time. Doc, do you think..." She stopped, looked down for a moment, and then back at Tony with a wry smile. "That's silly, isn't it? I don't know why I expect you to know more about it than I do. Oh, listen, they want you to stick around and monitor if they do have to open the crates. I'll let you know when it gets that far." This afternoon, the familiar splendors of the Martian scene evoked no glowing certainties in Tony's mind. He walked back from the lab in the early twilight, his eyes fixed on the far hills, his thought roaming bitterly beyond to the other side of the range. Tony had been to the new town just once to help out when a too hastily built furnace exploded. The injuries had been more than Pitco's green young doctor could handle all at once. The doctor's inexperience, like the faculty furnace, was typical. The whole place was temporary until it showed a profit for Pitco. When it did, solid structures would replace the jury-built shacks, and efficient company administration would put an end to the archaic social organization. But for now, the town was just a sprawling collection of ramshackle buildings, constructed of a dozen different inadequate materials, whatever was available in Marsport when a new house was needed. There was no thought of the future on other side of the hill, no worry about permanence, no eye to consequence. If the camp went bust, the population would move on to one of the newer locations, and move again when that one collapsed. If, on the other hand, the town survived, the population would move on anyhow. A new crop of workers would be imported from Earth, a tamer, quieter crew, to do routine work in an organized company town at considerably lower pay, and the boomtown adventurers would go to find higher wages and a freer life somewhere else. They struck no roots there, and they wanted none. Of all the widely scattered human settlements on Mars, the Sun Lake colony alone believed that man could and would someday flourish naturally on the alien soil. Anna Willendorf was a member whose skill was almost as much appreciated as Tony's, for a different reason. Plastics, produced in the lab, could be, and were, used for almost every item of furniture or furnishings in the colony. But for some chemical processes, glassware was still a must. And now that giant machines existed on Earth to turn out almost every conceivable glass utensil, glass blowers were far between, good ones almost non-existent. Without Anna's highly specialized talent, the colony would have had to pay a fabulous price for the transport of bulkily packaged glassware from Earth. Anna was one of the very few unmarried members of the colony who refused to participate in the communal meals. Laziness or embarrassment, or both, served to drag in the others, like Tony, who might have preferred to remain aloof. Anna simply ignored the questions and remarks. On rare occasions, however, she relented to the extent of inviting the doctor to dine with her, combining their rations and preparing a meal for him in her own one-room hut. Then for an hour she would play hostess to him, an hour that restored for both of them the longed-for feeling of gracious, civilized living. One for all and all for one. Mutual endeavor. Collective self-sufficiency. The whole thing, Tony thought angrily, was an anachronism. More than that, an impossibility. No sane man could believe in it, unless he came from Earth and had nothing to see to believe in. For tonight, at least, he was free of it. Anna was at the door when he reached it, holding it open for him. She watched him set down his bag as though he were unloading the troubles of the universe. "You need a drink," she decided. "Who's kidding whom?" he grinned sourly at her. "Some nice, refreshing, vitamin-packed, grade-A synthesized orange juice, maybe? I see you haven't been home yet." She disappeared behind the drape that hid her kitchen section. Not many of them bothered to separate the kitchen from the living room. Perhaps, Tony thought, that was what gave her room such a special look. A moment later, she was out again, with two long-stemmed, fragile glasses in her hands. She handed one to Tony, and awe and wonder crossed his face as he sipped. He looked his question at her over the rim of the glass. "I shouldn't have spoiled your surprise, really," she smiled at him. "The Candros. They wouldn't prepare anything for the baby, but they must have ordered these from Earth when Polly was just, let's see, 3 months along to have them here in time." "Real wine," Tony marveled and sipped again. "Aged wine. How did they get it? How could they afford?" "They couldn't, of course," she reminded him. "But they have relatives on Earth. You know they're not the only ones who left some cash behind, just in case." The doctor looked up sharply and found a faint smile flickering on her lips. "How did you know?" he demanded. "Where do you find out these things?" "What do they call it? Feminine intuition?" She shrugged and moved towards the kitchen again. "Which also tells me that supper will be a desiccated mess if I don't serve it right now." She'd set the table as usual in front of the big window. Tony took his place and looked out through the eerie twilight across the endless expanse of Lacus Solis. The ocean bed was like a vast black velvet now, studded with a million tiny glinting jewels. The doctor stared out until Anna returned with a steaming dish. He regarded her soberly and was planning a dutiful compliment when she burst into laughter and set the dish down. "Jim's face," she explained hastily. "It just crossed my mind. He's so proud of the wife and child." He was irked by a note of insincerity and supposed for a moment, neurotically he knew, commonest thing in the world, that she'd been laughing at him. "Nothing so funny," he said stiffly. "I'm sorry. Serve the greens." Dinner performed its usual magic. Tony had been really hungry. Tilting his chair against the wall with his empty pipe in his mouth, he found that things were getting back into proportion. "Anyhow," he said, "we still have time." They'd been talking about Belle's threat of quarantine. Through the daylight hours, it had seemed at least the end of the world. Now, with a pleasantly noticeable buzz from the wine in his head and a palpable meal digesting, above all, with some privacy and clear space and time around him, Tony couldn't recapture the sharp alarm of the threat. Anna very seriously demanded, "Do you think Belle can run us out?" He waved a little too expansively. "Probably not. Any number of other possibilities. Somebody at Pitco might have taken the stuff. They're close enough." "Nope," he hauled up. "Ed Neely wouldn't make a mistake like that. He was working the Bloodhound, and there's a boy who'll do any job the right way. Don't worry about it, though. It's 2 weeks to rocket landing, another week to shipment day. Something will turn up. We'll send O'Donnell to Marsport. If there's a legal angle, he'll find it. Maybe he can scare Belle into backing down. Belle's supposed to be a small-timer. He wouldn't want any real trouble." Anna got up abruptly and filled his empty glass. "Hey, you take some, too," Tony insisted. She made a show of draining the last few drops in her own glass. The rims touched, and they drank. "You're a strange girl, Anna," said Tony. "Hell, I didn't mean exactly that. I mean, you're not like the other women here. Joan, Bea, Polly, Verna." "No," she said. "Not very much like Bea." Tony didn't know whether she was angry or amused, and decided he didn't care. "I don't know why I don't marry you." "Two reasons," Anna smiled. "One, you're not sure you want to. Two, you're not at all sure I do." "No, I'm not." He hesitated. He was aware of painful pressure long neglected. It was the liquor, he told himself, or it was only the fact that the two of them were together. Anna's expression was somehow apologetic. Tony set down his empty glass. He reached for her and murmured something. It was conversational, and she smiled, and he had no idea what it was. They did not kiss. His hands had a life of their own, touching her. Anna was smiling, softly and a little sadly, and she whispered, "This isn't the time." He nodded without hearing, aware only that something very important was very close. His mouth tasted of wine and her flesh. He wanted her very badly in that moment. There was a sudden violent banging at the door, like an explosion in the quiet room, and then he realized what she'd said. But there was no time to ask her what she meant. There was only time to spring apart. Harv Stillman didn't wait for anyone to answer his thundering knock. He burst in. He noticed nothing, could hardly speak. He was white-faced and shaken. Too late. Time had gone. But Tony was a doctor. "Doc!" Tony jumped up and reached for his bag. "What is it? Joan? The baby? An accident at the lab. Flash from Marsport. The rocket's coming in." The radio man stopped to catch his breath. "They're inside radio range now. Estimated time of arrival? 4 a.m. "Tomorrow?" Anna gasped. Harv nodded, and Tony put down his bag with mechanical precision in the center of the table. Tomorrow. 3 weeks had been little enough time to find the Marcane and the thief and get rid of Bell's strangling cordon. Now, with the rocket in ahead of schedule, 2 of those weeks were yanked out from under them.